Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This week's episode of Screen Talk is brought to you by Let Them All Talk. Take a voyage with three legendary actresses, Academy Award winner Meryl Streep, Academy Award nominee Candice Bergen, and Academy Award winner Diane Wiest, as they come aboard a new Max original film by Academy Award winning director Steven Soderbergh. Meryl Streep plays author Alice Hughes, who must reunite with her two lifelong friends to right wrongs from the past and have a bit of fun along the way. Let Them All Talk, now streaming on HBO Max and rated R. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And Ann, we've got tons of stuff to talk about, movies from Netflix and Hulu and all kinds of other stuff. But first, this is kind of a sequel to last week's discussion where we were all ready to just do our top 10 lists and then the HBO Max news happened. And that's been continually developing. So to the surprise of absolutely no one, Christopher Nolan is pissed. So he came out.
We were all waiting with bated breath for that to drop, and it dropped.
It dropped gloriously. I mean, from a scandal standpoint, the vitriol that was dripping out of his official statement, calling this, you know, the worst streaming service and so forth. I mean, he's just lucky that this didn't happen when Tenet would have been affected. You know, well, he
Tenet,
has distance.
No, the point is that Tenet drove this decision.
There's
the
no question.
The point is that Warner Brothers was profoundly disappointed by what happened with Tenet and looked at the numbers. But this decision was made according to John Thithian, who's the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, and he did a big podcast this week with the box office folks. And he basically said it was an upstairs decision, you know, a John Stanky, Jason Kilar decision, and that the studio, I guess he was trying to kind of smooth relationship between Warner Brothers and the exhibitors for the future, which will continue to exist. There's an interesting divide between the people who are saying the sky is falling, it's the end of movies, it's the end of theaters, and the people like me. I really still believe, and we have people who listen to the podcast who are arguing with me about this. I do think this is a pandemic thing, an opportunistic thing, a thing where they, in the short term, can make some money, build some subscribers, and then return to some other model. A changed model, I grant you, but it's going to go back. They're going to go back to the theaters. It's the only way to make that much money.
They wouldn't if they didn't have to. I mean, that's part of it. We can't give them credit for the,
correct,
you know, like Nolan values the theatrical experience for cultural, aesthetic reasons that are, it's just a completely different value system than what's in play with the studios. So there's no way of kind of getting on the same page there. And I don't know, is it just because of, I don't think it's, we can put it all on Tenet in the sense that if you look at the 2021 slate of HBO, of Warner Brothers films that will now also be HBO Max films, none of those are surefire bets. Even Dune, we cannot just assume that that was obviously going to be a ginormous blockbuster success. I mean, Blade Runner 2049 was not. So it, on some level, you could also argue that, okay, so Tenet definitely informed discussions here, but also if they had this slate and tried to release these movies in theaters, it probably would have been a disaster no matter what.
During this period, yes. But they could have waited. That's the point that everyone is making. They could have waited like everyone else is waiting for things to come back. But there's a huge glut of product going through there, and they would have been competing. By the way, Wonder Woman 84 also informed the way that they announced the movie, which was such a shock to Hollywood. But, you know, they basically informed people, if they did at all, right before they dropped it, the news. And so they dropped the news of this new model without consulting their partners, the people who paid for Dune. And part of the reason for that was this negotiation that they had to go through with Warner, with Wonder Woman, to pay Jenkins, Patty Jenkins, and to pay Gal Gadot. How everything, it cost them like $10 million a piece to pay them off. And
I think they knew this was going to be a mess and needed to rush it out and
that's deal it. With the that's mess. It. They knew they were going to get huge blowback, that there would be these endless negotiations with everyone. And the other thing that they did go through with Tenet, which was so difficult for them, was this sort of constant chaotic shifting and moving. And I just know from inside Warner Brothers that they were all under serious duress the whole time. This way they know what the plan is, they know what they're doing, and there isn't any discussion about it. How they pay off their partners is going to be fascinating to watch. Because Netflix, when they make these worldwide deals, they pay people ahead of time for what that would be worth in the theatrical marketplace. And the question is, what is the theatrical marketplace? We don't know what its value is anymore.
Right now, it doesn't really exist. It's more of a symbolic, almost abstract concept for most people. It's also notable with on the Nolan front, he doesn't have a movie coming out next year. And I wonder how this conversation will continue to evolve. I mean, it happened that Nolan was doing press now for the Tenet home video and for international stuff. He was in India promoting the theatrical release there. And so he's talking about this stuff in part because he's sort of in promotional mode. But I wonder for this, you know, vast spectrum of filmmakers from Shaka King, who did Judas and the Black Messiah, to Denis Villeneuve, who hasn't commented publicly on this yet, what next year is going to be like when they have to promote these movies. How do you toe that party line and then also kind of deal with the fact that you're kind of pissed because they're not getting around this? Nobody is going to reverse this decision.
But on the other hand, what I sort of enjoy, I know this is awful, this is sort of a schadenfreude thing for me. These are entitled people who are, you know, someone like Chris Nolan.
Are you talking about the filmmakers?
Yeah.
Filmmakers entitled, you don't say.
They're used to being treated like God's gift to humanity. They have smoke blown at them constantly. And many of them, I'm a huge fan of Denis Villeneuve. I think he's one of the great filmmakers that we have. And I loved Blade Runner 2049. But this is a situation where the agencies and the people who negotiate these deals and the lawyers and the managers and the people who are running the companies that partner with Warner Brothers and finance the movies, all of these people are used to getting their cut of the pie. And it's a big, juicy pie. And they are getting shut out as if they aren't important.
Well,
and I find that fascinating.
It's fascinating, but also not surprising, right? 'Twas ever thus. Didn't we all see Mank? Well, don't answer that.
No, it's never been any different. But what you have with a paradigm shift like this, here's the thing. I've been saying this for a really long time, that the studios, the big studios have been more and more facade-like in terms of becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, the fewer executives, fewer projects in development, fewer deals, you know, fewer movies. And what's so weird about this is that Warner's was one of the bigger ones, one of the more deluxe studios that really spent a lot of money and did do a lot. They're all, over the last decade, they have all been coming down in size and in scope and importance. And now they're really not that important in the overall scheme of things. When you look at Disney, and we were going to talk about the fact that there's a big Disney earnings call today as we're recording this, we're expecting some news to drop there about what they're going to be doing. You see that movies are just this small blip inside that enormous corporation. And we all have to come back to recognizing that our world that we care about and the you and me with the indies, it's even smaller. It's even
tinier.
And it's
always been. But I embrace that because it has ways of affecting the larger equation. I mean, Pixar scouts for screenwriters out of Sundance and the ecosystem for films that don't necessarily reach a larger audience still is tremendously influential. It's a platform for filmmakers who don't have resources. I mean, the way in which people work to make movies these days has been mostly separated from the studio process for years now. So this kind of situation is just a grand illustration of all of that. And I don't find it to be that surprising in any particular kind of way, but it is a reminder on some level that if you choose to work on that scale as an artist, then at some point in time, you're not going to be in charge of things that, and things can happen that you don't agree with, and you just won't have a recourse. So, I mean, none of these movies that are in 2021, I don't feel bad for any of these filmmakers, honestly. I mean, these movies will be fine. They're going to reach a lot of people. But I do think that it is worth noting that there's going to be a lot of movies that come out in 2021 in unusual kinds of ways. And it was never even a possibility that they could reach a mass audience. You know, movies that get seen at Sundance or whatever other virtual film festivals are happening next year. Right? I mean, most of those movies are just not, it's not a discussion that they're going to come out on 3,000 screens. And it never would have been even pre-pandemic for a lot of stuff. So
now we're going to see real shrinkage. We're going to see shrinkage in the number of theaters that emerge from this intact. If the theaters don't get a big bailout from the government, and there's no guarantee that they will, that they'll even be included in the package that is out there, because from the point of view of the United States Senate and Congress, you know, they just may not think that movies are... There was one comment on IndieWire, which I looked at with some interest, where a woman was suggesting that why would you support a dying model? You know, why would you even give them money when you know they're on their way out?
I don't want to go there.
That's not where I am. But there are many who may think that way.
I don't know how savvy the Senate and the House are in terms of the future of exhibition and on that front. I mean,
it's this unimportant to them.
It's just not on their. It's on the periphery. But you know, do they recognize that it's not valuable to support this because it's a dying mode of experiencing entertainment? I don't know. I think that, again, on the exhibition front, to me, what's going to be more fascinating is to see how the wider exhibition community starts to crawl back, the art houses and individual places, because we live in such a fragmented country with different state regulations and all this kind of stuff. You know, what is exhibition going to be like beyond these questions of studio movies, which is just going to be a giant mess for a while and everybody kind of knows it.
Yeah, so no question. I'm curious on the Disney call, for example. I was just thinking about Fox Searchlight, which is part of Disney. It's no longer Fox. It's
Searchlight just Searchlight Productions,
part of Disney, and Old Habits Die Hard, and you know, we kept wondering, are they going to give movies to Hulu? Right? What's going on with Hulu? What is Hulu? And I like Hulu, and I use Hulu, and there's a lot of good stuff on there. FX is on there now, there's some conversations about Hulu being folded into Disney Plus. You know, to make it bigger and more robust. There's all sorts of questions on it. There's so many things on the table. It's exciting in a terrible way.
Yeah, exactly. We got to embrace the change, but also recognize people have jobs on the line, and it's just going to be a lot of confusion for a while. So hopefully that's heading in a direction of greater clarity as we continue to talk these things through. Well, speaking of the streamers, let's turn to a new Netflix film, because The Midnight Sky, which I know you got a really early look at, I finally got a chance to see as critics weighed in this week. And I have to tell you, there's a really fascinating divide between the way this film has been discussed from an awards prognostication standpoint and the critical reaction. I found the movie to be gorgeous and certainly had a lot of impressive craft on display and a strong Clooney performance, but so derivative of everything from Gravity to Solaris to all these other kinds of things that it just never kind of found its own voice. And that just really held it back for me. But you seem higher on it, I think.
I'm glad you appreciate the craft side of it. And that's where I think it has Oscar prospects, because it's such a lean year. I'm sort of damning with faint praise. I don't know how to explain this. It has to do with the fact that there's so few big movies, with scale and scope. And so I think that Martin Rue, the cinematographer, and Jim Bissell, the production designer, did a great job. There's outer space, there's Arctic wastes, there's lots of CGI, lots of action sequences with meteors hitting the space station and floating blood. And I thought that was very creative and very beautifully done.
A little too CGI heavy, that scene, for me.
Yeah, I thought it was, Alexandre Desplat does a beautiful job with the score. I agree with you, the acting is very good. He did do a weird thing where his younger self has Clooney's voice, and he did some very complicated mixing thing with his own voice and the guy.
I found that very difficult to work with.
Who's a Peck, a younger Peck, a Scott, is his name Scott Peck? He's a relative of Gregory.
I didn't realize that there was a lineage there. Well, I think that's a bit of an issue because who doesn't know what a younger Clooney looks like, right? I mean, it's a recent memory, the ER guy. I mean, it's so, to me, he was seemed to kind of diss the Irishman in your interview with them, saying that de-aging thing didn't. I thought that was a miscalculation because to me, a de-aged Clooney would have actually been something a lot of people would have enjoyed.
I'm not a fan of that whole process.
I think it would have worked in this particular because it's not as dramatic as de-aging Robert De Niro either.
But the voice took you out of it as much as the other thing would have done. So his own point is undermined.
But the guy didn't. The guy doesn't look enough like Clooney. I think, at least especially the way Clooney looks in this movie, where he looks like the Syriana character with the big beard.
I love the way
he
aged up and had.
Yeah, he's very. The first couple minutes.
Ill. Yeah, I love.
First couple minutes of this movie, he's like wandering this Arctic refuge, you know, drinking whiskey and listening to country music, and I was like,
and giving himself blood transfusion.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, this should be the movie. I mean, I think he's made three really good films. He's made Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. He did Good Night and Good Luck, which was amazing. And then I thought Ides of March was
I loved
very
Ides
strong.
Of March. Too.
Those three.
And I love
He's
Good Night and
director.
Good Luck. And Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, I always thought was a great, audacious first movie. I wasn't sure if it entirely worked. But
it tries stuff.
He loves directing. I mean, I talked to him and, you know, the man couldn't be more enthusiastic. I mean, he just engages with it and loves it. And he reminds me a little bit of Jodie Foster. There's a kind of extraordinary competence and understanding of how to work with actors and storytelling. And yet he does, I think you're right, he doesn't have his own voice somehow as a director and writer. You know, he loves playing with the toys and he loves getting into it, but
well, you could argue that Good Night and Good Luck is the most personal film he did, you know, his father being a broadcast journalist and all that, and you feel it in the material. It was a very risky kind of filmmaking that was incredibly mature and didn't, you know, slow down to explain itself, and that's a hard thing to pull off. I mean, it was recognized as such, so I'm surprised he didn't stay on that path consistently, but it's hard.
He's on a Clint Eastwood path, and it's an interesting question because he follows some of Clint's approach. They're both big movie stars, and we should never forget that movie stars are powerful and get their own way, and everybody services them. But at the same time, there's a certain humility in the way that they do things, and they don't do a lot of takes. They keep it low, the budget. They don't go overboard. They're not control freaks like Robert Redford or Warren Beatty. They keep moving, and I just think that he has some really good movies in him in the future, and I'm rooting for him.
Yeah, and I mean, the guy's turning 60 next year, is obviously in this, you know, at a turning point of sorts, trying to figure out what is the best use of his time, and yet, as you also pointed out in your piece, sold his whiskey company.
He has what we call fuck you money.
Yeah, he's like on the cusp of it.
He
let's
shared
put it
$1 billion and say when he sold the company.
Well, no, it's Mark Cuban said there's fuck you money and then there's fuck everybody money or something like that. I think he's in fuck you. He's not quite in fuck everybody, so he's still got to be a little careful about what he does. But it is notable because to be somebody like that, you have so many directions that you can go. All right, so if Midnight Sky is primarily an awards play from a technical standpoint, and Clooney is not, you know, sort of a slam dunk kind of best director nominee, it does come back to this question of, you know, Netflix has so much stuff, but what stuff is sort of at the top of the list? Is Chicago 7 still sort of coasting along? Because Mank does not seem to have been huge on Netflix. I mean, I still really like this movie. I love debating it with people. I'm fascinated by the different perspectives on it, but it doesn't seem like audiences were over the moon about it. And it certainly doesn't seem like the Academy members who have seen it have been sort of universally, you know, over the moon. So it's really hard to tell, but it does seem like there's only Chicago 7 and Ma Rainey that are the ones that kind of stand out as kind of strong
You're right. Those are
contenders
the
here.
two top titles for Netflix. Ma Rainey is really strong. I could see Viola Davis and Chadwick Boseman both winning their respective categories. Mostly because Frances McDormand has won twice in recent memory, and a third Oscar just seems hard to fathom. It's just the way the Oscars work. It could happen, but it's more likely that a showy, costumey, makeup-y singing performance, even if she doesn't sing all the songs herself, from Viola would be the best actress win for her. And the movie is just so sublimely satisfying. I just think it's going to be a big winner. And those could be the things it wins, the two acting prizes. And
Well, an
Chicago 7.
IFP. Well, I was just gonna say the Gotham Awards IFP is giving the two of them special prizes, which indicates where that campaign is heading. And actually, I thought it was interesting. They're giving awards to those two, and also to Steve McQueen and to Ryan Murphy. So that covers a wide range of the streaming space in the
All right,
fall
so the
season.
streamers are dominating the conversation right now. We have Amazon with One Night in Miami, and we have obviously we've got all the Netflix movies. There's so many of them, even if they don't all land. But they're making noise, and Apple is making noise as well with On the Rocks. The A24 is pushing, but Minari. But where are we with the specialty distributors? They're not making as much noise as the streamers are now. And I think what's going on is that they're actually going to come around later, and because they're still waiting for
They got time.
theatrical.
They were given time, so they're using their time, which I think makes a lot of sense. It's like in a basketball game, you use the time you have for those timeouts. Why go now when you can go later? It just seems like there's space and they
But there's
should use
also
it.
a lot of work under, they're sort of like ducks paddling, the legs are moving. They're doing a lot of work under the surface. They're doing a lot of guild screenings and Q&As and all that stuff that they would ordinarily be doing out in the world. We just aren't as aware of it.
The guild screen, that's always interesting because I mean, this time of year, usually we pop into a SAG screening or moderate a DGA thing or whatever, and
Well, we're
now
doing
it's
some of
like
those things
we are.
online.
No, we are, but you don't see it in the same way. It doesn't it's almost like it's a secret online club thing that you either are watching or not. It's like you have to have a passcode to watch this TV show that happens to be a guild Q&A or
Yeah, I mean,
something.
last night I asked for and got access to this San Francisco Film Festival Awards thing that they were doing with Chloe Zhao and Aaron Sorkin and Glenn Close, the cast of One Night in Miami, and they actually had Academy members from the San Francisco area interviewing them online. And it was sort of, ordinarily they would be schmoozing in all these different parties and opportunities to charm their quarry, but it was sort of a bizarre one-on-one situation.
All right, so another streaming movie that I happened to catch up with, you mentioned it briefly last week, and I felt like I had to fill in the gap just so I could know, and that was Happiest Season, which I have to tell you really disappointed me,
I was going to say,
shockingly.
so you tell me, Eric, why was that the number one movie over Thanksgiving weekend for
Well,
everyone?
this was originally supposed to be a studio theatrical release, right? I mean, that was sort of the idea because I don't think in theaters anyone would have cared about this movie, but people crave those holiday movies, and it had a star. It has, a lesbian hook to a genre that we've seen before. I
Very
think those
familiar,
aspects of it,
very
and
conventional.
it presents itself as a very accessible kind of crowd pleaser. I think what I found so frustrating about it is that, in spite of that, it just felt very tame to me. I mean, you have this great dynamic, right? This great premise of, Kristen Stewart has to go to her girlfriend's house. And her girlfriend hasn't come out yet. Will she come out? But then the family, which has a there's a political dynamic to the family. Presumably, this is a fairly conservative conservative family with, you know, Republican beliefs. The fact that the movie never explicitly acknowledges that, or even what their value system is, like, are they homophobic? Do they, what kind of, how did they raise their kids?
They
what is driving that?
They kind of gave the father the generic role of politician. And that put him in the public eye, you know, and it could have gone either way. It could have been Boston Brahmin, you know, it could have been New York.
In an America
Brahmin.
Of 2020, it just felt so dated and kind of lame to me to not dig into that. I actually thought K-Stu was really strong in the role.
She was very good. I
really
thought she
gets
was
into
brilliant.
It. And there's a moment where... And there's a moment where she makes a decision with Eugene Levy, who I thought was a really kind of crass supporting character. Dan Levy. Yeah, they look so similar. To me, it's almost like a de-aging
thing. I like Dan Levy.
Thing.
I thought he was probably one of the... You know, I was a little annoyed by the fact
that... I'm not saying he's not funny. He's underdeveloped. That's the problem.
Annoyed by the fact that in a movie written by and executed by women, he, as the guy, was given a lot of the wisdom of the piece.
He was like this guru. He's like the,
he's like the
Yoda
advisor.
Who pops in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't love that, but I did think there was a crucial moment that I guess I shouldn't spoil for whatever reason.
It's pretty late in the day now. People who have seen that movie have seen
the
movie.
Spoiler alert. Well, okay, fine. So spoiler alert, Kristen Stewart seems to be making the decision with her pal that this relationship is not for her, which is a normal human thing to come around to. And then we still got a stupid scene at the gas station where her girlfriend gets one last chance. Like, it just felt to me like such a negation of a really credible transformation that this character goes through, from assuming that these characters, that they're destined to be together, to realizing that it simply doesn't work. And then it just rushes through all this stuff. And that felt to me like a repudiation of the depth that Kristen Stewart actually brought to the part. And that really annoyed me.
I was yelling at the screen. I was saying, leave her. Don't get together with her. Go.
Do you think they did it to troll you?
Aubrey Plaza.
Aubrey Plaza, again, totally underutilized, by the way.
Absolutely. The out gay characters were the people I was rooting for throughout the movie. And because that's how the movie's set up. The straights are not smart and not cool. But I would say that she engages us. So the fact that we got so caught up in it was, we put up a story from Clea DuVall explaining why she did the way she
Clea
did.
DuVall is an interesting filmmaker, and I hope that she gets more work out of this, since it's been so popular and continues to do this kind of genre that often seems underutilized. It's not like it doesn't show you anything about why it shouldn't work. It's just not a fully realized concept. And I wish it, you know, having the eyeballs it has, having the people involved that it has, I wish it went further. I wish it had a more realized universe to it.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you, but I want to see what she does next. You know, I think she's a smart director, I'd like to see what she does next. And speaking of romantic comedies, I have to say that I have a guilty pleasure for all of you. A terrible movie that David Ehrlich correctly lambasted in a very entertaining review, which you should all read if you haven't read, that introduced me to the existence of such a thing as a soda farl, which is an Irish sweet cookie of some kind. That's what he compares. Wild Mountain Time from John Patrick Shanley. I loved Moonstruck. I've always loved Moonstruck, but it was directed by Norman Jewison. And that's the difference here. Shanley directed this play himself as a movie and put it in Ireland and put real people in it, including Emily Blunt and the great Christopher Walken, who's delightful, and Jamie Dornan, who is dumbfounding, even if he's good to look at, and John Hamm, thank you. I'm so glad he's in the movie. But it is over the top, total magical mystery tour romance, and there was a part of me that wanted it very badly and enjoyed it despite its craziness.
Well, I will try to check it out.
You'll hate it.
I mean, who knows? Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. It sounds more engaging.
I called it Unhappiest Season.
Yeah, but it sounds it's a different category of experience. I'm certainly into just seeing random stuff right now like this, because we've entered that weird period of the year where I have this almost like Dr. Manhattan-esque ubiquity when it comes to awareness of films that are out there with very few exceptions. I mean, I feel like I've really seen almost everything of note. I have maybe 3 or 4 significant blind spots that I don't want to detail right now, because I'm going to try to get to them in the next week or so. But it's been a really good year for the movies.
By the way, you opted to do your, a lot of the movies that are coming out in 2021 qualified in 2020 in order to be considered by the New York Film Critics and the LA Film Critics. Because the critics are still really important, even if Critics' Choice and Globes are down the pike and they have different rules. But you chose to go, I mean, I went along with you because you did it first, but why not wait on the 10 bests if you're still catching up with films?
Every year people complain about how early it gets. To me, I start keeping a list of my favorite movies of the year in January, in part because I see a lot of them the year beforehand. It's just because when you go to festivals and you pay attention to these movies and we use the release date as sort of the determining factor, you enter the year with a pretty robust list. And my blind spots did not seem substantial enough to wait, especially, as you know, being part of a competitive news organization and wanting to be part of the initial wave of reactions, there wasn't enough there, I felt. I mean, maybe Wild Mountain Time would have changed everything.
I don't think so. That's not going to be one of the contenders for the year.
Look, we got a chance to see a lot of stuff.
When do you guys vote?
We vote a week from this week's Friday, so next week we'll have to figure out our timing exactly. But yeah, we're about a week out from New York Film Critics Circle, and I'm fielding questions from people all the time about qualifications and what do we think is gonna, you know, get into the conversation. You can tell how publicists try to play you. They say, "Do you think X performance has a chance?" Which is really just a way of reminding you that this performance. And I think the challenge is that people always assume they know what's going to happen. Like, oh, this movie is a critic's favorite, so it's obviously going to win everything. But the critics are very engaged voters, especially this voting body, which is the largest it's ever been, I think. And
how many?
It's close to 50 people, and I suspect most will participate. Sometimes people are unavailable just because it's going to be an online voting process and all that kind of stuff. And there's tons of stuff, and people want to see as much as they can. Most people are doing top 10 lists and rushing to fill in gaps the way that I have. So I think that the vote's going to be all over the place, and we shouldn't take anything for granted. But I have no idea.
I do think Nomadland and Minari are likely to do well with the group.
You would think those would be certainly Nomadland, which, you know, Searchlight Pictures qualified that movie, it seems, in order to put it on track for critics.
That's right.
Wins, but that, who knows? I haven't polled all the members of our group, so I don't know if everyone is as big a fan of that movie as they might be of some of the other things that are in contention. I mean, there's a lot of international stuff and docs, and I think the vote, we'll see what happens with Best Picture, but certainly the vote for performances and screenplay and doc are just going to be all across the map. And that means probably multiple rounds of voting and who knows what emerges on top in that situation. It's really, it's going to be unpredictable, which, by the way, is great. We should embrace that, because unpredictability is what makes this kind of worthwhile. So next week, I guess we'll dig further into that, and we'll have a Sundance lineup to talk about. So that's super exciting too.
I'm really curious to see what ends up in Sundance. I think there's some distributors that are not submitting, and I'm curious to see where the big holes are.
Lots of big surprises there. Okay, Anne, well, stay sane over the weekend, and I will see you soon.
Bye-bye, Eric.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.